When did you start bringing everything downstairs, just so you don't have to go back upstairs again? Joint Relief Institute. Move better, live better without surgery. Call 708-888-0000.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. Thanks very much for joining us this week. I would love to hear from you. What are you reading? You can send me an email at stevebertrandonbooks@gmail.com, and I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast as well. Courtney Maugham's latest book wants you to slow down, and she offers that lesson in a very funny, occasionally poignant story called Alan Opts Out, and she joins us now. Courtney, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Well, I really enjoyed the book. And from what I understand, I have Stanley water bottles to thank for this.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have a tween daughter. And so at whatever point it was, several years ago, all of a sudden, all of her kind of tweeny bop friends were coming by with these massive, massive vessels, you know, the Stanley water bottles, and they had stuff dangling off of them, and you know, and I was watching it bloom on Instagram, and people were getting 7, 8, 18, you know, all different colors to match their outfits.
You couldn't find them. It was hard to find them sometimes.
Right. You could get the fake ones, which, like, right. My, you know, well, I wouldn't let my daughter have one, but and I just thought, what in the world, first of all, is happening to everyone's water bottles that they already have? Because in America, we're always ready for drought, you know.
Right,
people
exactly.
are really carrying around extra water. And then I thought, what are we doing? Oh, look, yeah, I've got mine.
We're holding our own water bottle.
Yeah, I mean, just in case, you know, the apocalypse comes, we're ready.
But I just thought, I'm going to interrupt you. Can I tell your story? Because it's...
Yeah, please.
I should wait, but I'm not going to.
No.
This is a brand, this water bottle. Maybe it says Owala or something.
Yep.
I have no idea.
The young ladies love that brand.
So I'm at the health club, and this guy comes up to me and goes, "Hey, nice water bottle." And I'm like, what are you talking about? But that's where we are, right?
And it's pistachio colored, I guess we should say, isn't it?
It is. It's very nice pistachio.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's now my daughter's 12, and that's the brand she wants. Stanley's out, as I imagine that, you know, it would be. And that's the brand that's in. So,
Owala.
Yeah, I just felt like it. The conspicuous consumption to me was so just encapsulated in this Stanley water bottle trend. And Stanley's a good company, you know. They made insulated water bottles before anyone else was doing that, for anglers, you know, for an actual reason.
Okay, so that's interesting. So you bring up the fact that Stanley is creating this product and driving us to buy it, which is a lot what your principal character, one of your principal characters, Alan Anderson, does, right? This opens up with him trying to get a milk deal. He's an ad man.
And
he wants to tell us what to drink.
He's an ad man, and he wants to, you know, his work is basically whatever you're doing now, eating, looking like, dressing, I don't know, using to wash your body, change it, and now you must get something completely different. So, when the book opens, he is trying to land the biggest account of the year, which is U.S. dairy, because nobody's drinking cow's milk anymore. They're drinking all these alternative milks. So that's the big kahuna that all of the agencies are trying to land. And he is positive that he will get it because he closes everything.
He will measure his life by whether he does.
Yeah, quite literally. Yeah, you'll explore in the book that, it's a real...
At home, there's in beautiful Bellport, which is a community on the Sound in Connecticut. Is it Connecticut?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. His wife, Vivian, I guess it is trying to win a deal of her own. Tell me about the Queen Anne's in Bellport.
So the Queen Anne's is a private women's social club where they celebrate the domestic and feminine arts, and it's extremely exclusive. Every summer, they pick three people to more or less haze throughout the summer to see if they'll make it into this private women's club or not. And the hazing, to me, it's really scary. I've had a couple readers writing me like, oh, I would kill this. I'd be so good at it. But you don't know when this is going to come. But at any moment, you could get a call or a text that, you know, within 2 hours, you're hosting, I don't know, a ceviche table arranging a party at your house, or surprise, there's 900 loads of hydrangeas being sent to your house and you're doing a floral arranging party. And so all summer long, the sort of initiates have to really show up in these very kind of traditionally feminine ways. And it culminates in a dinner party where each candidate has to show off, you know, what they've learned, and then, you know, they pick someone. So Vivian, this summer for her, is extremely important that she looks perfect, her kids are well behaved, the yard looks great, the grass is the right height, you know, all these external factors really matter.
It's like a wealthy suburban Mean Girls.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly, that could encapsulate it very well.
And then the two daughters you mentioned, Bailey and Sunny, go to exclusive schools. And I only bring this up, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but there's just a great line where Vivian is at one of the schools and they say, you know, Bailey wants to put on a play. She's at her school, and someone at the school says, well, you know, we don't do Shakespeare because the community has a lot of problems with Shakespeare, which I laughed out loud at.
It's a Montessori school, and she can't do a play with Shakespeare because Shakespeare is problematic.
Right.
And Vivian's just like, hasn't he been dead for so long? Like, okay, you know, she's just like, all right, I just have too much to worry about. I can't worry about Shakespeare and his problems.
Do you know people like Alan and Vivian?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I have a lot of Alan in myself. I have a 20 years background in advertising, and then I've had some Vivians in my life, definitely.
Do you keep them or you drop them?
Well, one of them is maybe related to me, so drop. Yeah,
what's your email? I'll send her this. Yeah. Okay, let's go back to the ad pitch, though, for the U.S. Dairy, because Alan has gone to Wisconsin, or come to Wisconsin, found this farmer, Tucker, who's going to add some genuineness to the pitch. Tucker doesn't make it, and another Tucker guy shows up, this guy,
Daniel.
Tell me, and that's where the crack starts for Alan.
The crack. Daniel literally seems to open a portal where Alan's life completely shifts. It's sort of unclear and vague. Alan's super upset and has a hard time getting accountability around what happened, but they sent on an airplane, they sent the wrong guy. You know, he was trying to get a weathered white man in his 60s who looks like he's got calluses on his hands and like has spent his whole life under a cow's udder. And they send this sort of like sex bomb. like I think of him as like a Jacob Elordi type. Like you can't, he's tall. Very attractive, like attractive in a way where Alan's like, oh God, like how do I spin this?
Right.
And because he's too attractive. Yeah.
His message is very different as well.
Yes. He does not stay the course with the marketing messages that Alan had aligned on with Tucker, which is just like, you know, while all these other alternative milks are out there being like woke and fussy, you know, milk is sort of the like Virgin Mary of all, you know, just like you can always rely on milk. He puts a lot of sort of faith messaging in it, putting like real down home Americana messaging around milk's purity and simpleness. And Daniel, I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but he's got his own agenda, and it's around over farming and things like that.
Yeah, right. Pointing out that maybe advertising's part of the problem, not the solution.
Exactly.
I just noticed his last name is Ellery, Daniel Ellery. Was that because of Jacob Elordi?
It wasn't. It wasn't. Okay. I actually have never spoken that. Connection out loud. It's just I had my book launched yesterday and someone came up and said, like, I have a huge crush on Daniel in the book. Who would he be if it turned into a movie or a show? And I was like, I hadn't thought about it. I had thought about it. I wrote him. I had Matthew McConaughey in my head, but he's supposed to be younger. So yesterday out of nowhere, I was like, oh, Jacob Elordi would be amazing. No, I didn't have him in mind. I actually had Matthew McConaughey in mind.
Well,
Texas.
We broke a little news here then. We've fine-tuned Daniel.
Jacob, call me. I mean,
we'll make it happen. Movie rights are out there. And so then, I don't want to give away too much, but obviously the name of the book is Alan Opts Out.
Yeah.
And so he recognizes perhaps the error of his ways and starts living in the shed behind this McMansion.
Oh, it's a luxury playhouse, if you please.
I'm sorry, right. With the front porch.
It has a little front porch. So this was a trend I saw myself growing up in Greenwich, Connecticut. That's a really wild trend. People started to have these custom playhouses built to replicate exactly the main house, but in a child size version. And they start at like $30,000. It's a wild, wild thing. So when Alan bought his house, there was already this playhouse mm-hmm. on the property, and his daughter sort of used it during COVID to, you know, quote unquote study, but it's been sort of derelict, not really used. So yeah, he takes it. He moves Courtney, into the playhouse.
We're talking to Courtney Malm. The name of the book is Alan Opts Out. It's very funny, but with a valuable message. Excuse me, where are you sitting right now?
I am in a shed. not a luxury playhouse, but I am in a garden shed that we renovated for my husband to have an office in the backyard. So honestly, the distance from the main house like kind of replicates the shed that I'm in. This is where my husband is allowed to work during the day.
It's a very nice shed, I have to say. There's not a lawnmower.
Nice.
There's no weed whacker behind you in that
shed.
It
has been removed. We moved that stuff to the garage. Yeah, so it is really nice.
Okay,
yeah.
So we've got two people in a race. Alan was in the race for this deal. Vivian's in a race to be joined by to join the Queen Anne's.
Exactly.
As Alan starts to, well, I'm going to use the word devolve, but that's not the right way. Maybe evolve is better.
Yeah, I like devolve.
Did you play with the language at all? Did you write him differently? Tell me, I'm interested in that.
Yeah, I definitely did. You know, he opens the book, and the first chapter is bombastic. It's very caffeinated. He's overly confident. He's quite cocky. He's really like a rooster in the sky, because pretty quickly in the first chapter, he's in an airplane. And his sentences, there's no run-on sentences. They're pretty direct, clear. He's not doing a lot of metaphors or anything like that. I would argue it's very masculine, kind of corporate masculine style.
Alpha.
And yeah. And the longer he lives in the playhouse, partly from dehydration and having too many bug bites, he starts to spin out a little bit, and he's, you know, it's up to the reader to decide whether maybe he actually is a little ill, because he starts doing the opposite. Lots of run-on sentences, lots of kind of wild imaginary thinking. He spins from one idea to another, and he's making lists that are sort of new agey. And yeah, his tone changes. Yeah, that was on purpose.
So, well, he's living in the shed with, by the way, a lobster.
Yes, Lenny, the domesticated lobster.
His wife, Vivian, who was Valerie, she recreated herself, right?
He rebranded, yeah.
Do you know people who've done that?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
So they changed their name, or what are they?
Yeah. They just announced that. This happened to me with a friend not too long ago, actually. They just sort of announced that now they would be known as, you know, whatever name. But Vivian doesn't announce that. She rebrands before she comes to New England.
She arrives as Vivian.
She does not feel that Valerie is sort of an upper class Greenwich, Connecticut name. But she would die if anyone knew that her name was Valerie.
Okay, you steered me away. I want to go back to your life. So this person who rebranded.
Yeah. You can get me in trouble.
What did you say to her, or how did you? Where are
I
you?
Mean, I'm. There's been, frankly, there's quite a few people who have done that, and often, sometimes it's like people that have gone to Costa Rica for too long to do a yoga retreat, and they come back, and you know, they have a new evolved name, or it has to do with their religion. I don't know. But my friend in town, I mean, I just try to use it, you know. But it,
yeah.
I think I see her less because I get so worried about using the wrong name. And it's different. Like, we're not talking about dead names. You know, if someone changes their gender identity, you know, often there'll be a different name. This is not that. This is just someone who, you know, coming into age 50 felt that her name would be better if it was something else. So I signed a book for her last night to the new name, but
You know, not to get serious here, but I have a transgender daughter, so.
Oh, okay.
So I certainly understand what you're saying, and for her, it's very serious. For Valerie, it's a bit frivolous. It's very
Again, though, if she was outed in Greenwich, Connecticut, by her old name, if people found out that she changed her name from Valerie to Vivian just to sound fancier, she would die. I mean, that would be an absolute
horrifying,
true drama for her. She would, her system would really, really experience that as mortification. So for her, it's not frivolous at all. And she very much relies on Alan to keep that a secret forever. You know, it's a big thing for her. It represents everything she left behind, the lower class life she left behind, you know. So yeah, it's pretty consequential for her.
And obviously there's these two characters evolve. There's a revolution in the story that I think we'll just stay away from because people read the
probably.
Book. Except she throws a party.
She throws a party.
The dinner party she's supposed to. And the theme is Alice in Wonderland, which certainly wasn't an accident.
No, it wasn't an accident. And she focuses on the Mad Hatter tea party. That's the vibe. Everything's like the chairs are kind of strung up in the trees. The tables are at different levels. Everything's topsy-turvy. And her life, of course, is topsy-turvy, too. And she's literally living with the Mad Hatter in the form of Alan. So, yeah, it was narratively, it felt fitting. But, you know, she took on a lot because, like, it's hard enough to throw a fancy dinner party, but to have one that also has, like, kind of special effects and surrealist aspects and in the food. Oof, I wouldn't want to. I was just saying to a friend last night, like, oh God, I wouldn't. You could cut off my hand before I'd throw a party that complicated, you know?
So your opening party was last night, your book unveiling?
Yeah, my book. I did the opening.
How was that day for you?
It's good. This is my sixth book, so I know the mistakes I've made in the past, which is gluing myself to the computer and waiting for like Oprah to call. And she usually doesn't, right?
So instead, you got me. I'm quoting.
Yeah, I got you though. Yeah, which is just much better. So frankly, yesterday I just like woke up. I read a little bit. I'm reading the new Patrick Radkin Keefe, and then I went to my barn. I'm a obsessive horse girl, and I just rode, you know. And then I had a podcast, and then I had to get dressed, you know. But I tried to stay offline, and I did the same thing today.
Do you read the reviews? Do you learn from the reviews, or?
So I read what I call like professional reviews written by professionals, always. Even if my publicist warns me, like, "Ooh, this one's a little bit of a dig," I will read it. What I never read are my Amazon or Goodreads reviews. If you're listening to this, I still would love you to leave one
and leave a comment, please.
Many 5 stars, please, only. Otherwise, you can keep quiet. No, we can take a 4, 4.5. But I don't go into Amazon and Goodreads because I never have. But there's just no question in my mind that I could see 10 amazing reviews that are just make me feel really good. And then that one that's written in a mean manner that just feels really cutting will just stick inside me like a burr. I know that because I've written a lot of like op-eds for big publications like New York Times or The Guardian. And I do tend to read, well, I used to read the comments, and gosh, when people, they can be really cruel in a way that I find sort of violent to my system.
I worked in radio for 40 years. In the last 3 or 4, we had text lines where if people call in lines, people stop calling. They were texting. And and people feel emboldened. They think they're anonymous and they will just write the most cruel things.
I mean, awful.
What they didn't realize was that I had their phone number.
Oh God.
When they texted. So I would call them. I would just call. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Like, hey, I just saw this, what you said about me on the text line, and I just thought maybe we'd talk about it.
Well, how did they react?
Well, almost always they said, oh, I was just kidding, or I didn't mean it, or.
But you know, you're doing the Lord's work there because you're reminding people that there's a human with sensitive feelings and emotions, who could be having a really hard day,
right,
you know,
right.
on the other side of whatever it is they're doing. And I think it's so vital that people remember that, whether you're leaving a review for a restaurant you didn't like, or you're texting into a radio show. Like, there's hardworking people, you know, making sure the sound sounds good, preparing, you know, cutting up your salad, like the line cooks. There's just, everyone has a lot going on and they're struggling. And I just want to keep a positive attitude. So I don't venture into the Amazon and the Goodreads, but everything else, absolutely. Every other review written by someone who, you know, professional who took the time, 100%.
But there are fewer and fewer of those, right? I mean,
totally.
Literary criticism is kind of going away,
yeah.
or at least fading.
Or changing. It's changing into something else. Like, I just did a lovely talk with Lee Haber over on Substack. So Lee ran for 15 years the Oprah Book Club.
Mm-hmm.
And now she has sort of a book club, book reviewing thing on Substack. The places where the conversations are being had about books are changing a little bit, but I think we'll get there. I think we'll find a way for people who really, first of all, excelled at talking about books, were really clever and intelligent and generous in the way they talked about books. That doesn't mean they have to like them. We'll find out where to go, you know. And I also think that this, you know, the end of magazines and newspapers will be temporary.
I think there'll be
a comeback. I really do.
I think,
frankly, people can get all up in arms about it. But this is just how trends are. I used to work as a trend forecaster in France. And if the jeans are skinny, then next year there'll be bell bottoms. If the tops are cropped, then they're going to be baggy. It's pretty like rhythmic, you know.
We're talking to Alan Anderson about how she corrupted your life.
Well done. Exactly.
You work with writers as well, right?
I do. Yeah, in a coaching and educational capacity.
So I've always, and I've been doing this for a long time, but do you think there is a great book out there that is unread? Do you think someone has written a book that just hasn't found the outlet that might be a classic one day?
Oh, well, there's many more than just one book.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think at the micro press level, especially, and the independent press level, you know, publishers like Catapult, Tin House. I mean, Tin House is really rising in recognition, but I don't know, there's like presses like Unnamed Press or Creature Publishing, Creature Publishing is it's feminist horror.
Mm-hmm.
And like, they have some amazing things going on over there. And, you know, there's probably thousands of those books, because what happens at the micro press level or the academic press level or in certain indies is that there's absolutely no money for publicity. And most writers will not have received an advance substantial enough to hire their mm-hmm. own publicity help, nor, frankly, is it worth it? We can get into it or not. Freelance publicists have a hard, hard job right now. So how the heck do you find out about these books? Unless you know, one is already super interested in what's happening at the micro press level, which would necessitate that either you have an incredible bookshop that carries like chat books and things like that, or you get your patootie to AWP, this massive conference and festival of books, changes cities every year, and they have a stadium-sized book fair where there's every single micro press, academic press, the smaller presses, they're all there. And so people come with suitcases and buy up everything. And I mean, there is such exciting work happening at that level, but you'll never hear about it unless, you know, you have a well-read friend. So
so the answer is yes.
Yeah, like right now at the top of my head, I think there's this book called The Dead Book, and I can't remember. Because I'm not in my office, I can't grab it. But the Dead Book, it might be Unnamed Press or something. But it's a book that just reckons with mortality, and it's small, a chapbook size, and it contains the world inside it.
Mm, that's special.
You know, there's another one called Kick the Latch.
Yeah.
These are all, there's just so many. You'll have to email me and I'll put a list together. I'm like, mad I'm not in my office because those books, I keep them right behind me.
The what do you tell writers when they sit down with you? What's the overriding sort of, what's the pearl?
I don't tell them, well, I often start out by asking people, are you fully wedded to the traditional publication path? Like, does it mean a lot to you to try to get an agent and a traditional book deal? And if so, why? And I try to suss out, is it ego or what's going on? And then I ask them, like, are you comfortable and do you understand how long it could take in this current market and very competitive market to get an agent and then book deal? And we talk through that. And then what I work in kind of a curious way. I don't read the full manuscript. I ask my clients or students for a summary document, like a query letter or one page summary. And then I just stress test the manuscript as a whole. So I'll ask them like 45 minutes worth of questions, trying to understand where the book could falter. You know, so I might start hearing that, oh, there's a few too many characters and it's unclear why. Or, okay, the sort of problems that you've set up for your character, they're all cerebral.
So you're confident confident to do that to a writer without reading the book?
Yeah, because also they know that that's the process. So I generally read 5 pages and then the summary document. But the thing that's really cool, Steve, is that you can ask the students, but it creates the best, most open, candid and supportive conversation because I haven't read the book, because their feelings aren't hurt.
You're right. Yeah, that's a great point.
And I say all the time, like, okay, let's remember I haven't read it, but what it sounds like, and I'm just trying to replicate the experience of pitching to an agent who hasn't read it, doesn't really have time to read it, and is probably like positioned to say no, just because everything's so hard. And so it's actually pretty rare that they'll be in front of someone who has read the whole book. So I see it as a service, but I promise you it works out so well because they can always protect themselves by saying, oh, it was a little hard what I heard, but she hasn't read the book, right? So she doesn't know my special brand of genius. It works really, really well.
They don't start defensively. Courtney Malm, exactly. The name of her book is Alan Opts Out. I could talk to you all day, Courtney. It's about it's about an ad man who drops out and lives in his luxury shed in his backyard. And Courtney, as a matter of fact, is talking to us from her husband's luxury shed.
The he shed.
I really enjoyed the book. I enjoyed the conversation even more. Thank you.
Steve, thank you.
Courtney Malm. This is Steve Bertrand on Books. Thanks very much for listening. And we'll be back next week. I'd love to hear from you, Steve Bertrand on Books. @gmail.com. Even more importantly, subscribe. Tell your friends to subscribe. Tell your waiter who's getting bad Google reviews to subscribe. We could use them all. Courtney, thank you.
Thank you.